Welcome to the Center for Global Initiatives podcast, a production of the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing Center for Global Initiatives. Tune in monthly to hear from Johns Hopkins students and faculty about their travels, projects, experiences with, and thoughts on global health nursing.
Welcome to the second episode of the Center for Global Initiative podcast, where we talk to Nicole Warren. Dr. Warren is an assistant professor and a certified nurse midwife. Her work and research focuses on reproductive health in sub-Saharan Africa. And today, we're going to talk about her work with the GEMS program, establishing a postpartum screening tool in Mali. So welcome, Nicole.
Hi, thanks Dr. for having Warren. Me.
Nicole's good.
So just to kick it off, can you talk a little bit about your background and how you became involved in nursing and subsequently global health?
Sure. So as an undergrad, I studied telecommunications, but I knew from the time I started undergrad that I wanted to do something that would expose me to basically, I think, a level of development and economic well-being that was different from what I knew. So I just had it in my head that Peace Corps would be the best way to try and explore that. Excuse me. So I went into Peace Corps right after undergrad, and after about 5 minutes, it was really clear to me that I wouldn't be in telecommunications because I think when you're in a low-resource setting, you automatically the needs are obviously quite clear because everything boils down, at least it seemed to me at the time, that you needed to have a setting where people can reproduce safely. People need to be able to drink safe water or else you have no health, and if you have no health, you have no community or economy or anything else. So I just wanted to start working at the foundation. So just by chance, I started working with a community health worker, and she was a midwife. And so that was my first exposure to pregnant women, to birth at all. And I came home, you know, 2 years later, I had a pretty clear idea that I needed a nursing and a midwifery skill set and a public health skill set. So that sort of just started my journey toward the pieces I thought I needed to return and be of use sometime.
And so since you've entered into nursing and global health, has all of your focus been on Mali, or have you worked largely in sub-Saharan Africa also?
Yeah, so I think one thing I learned in Mali that at the end of 2 years, I was just beginning to understand what I didn't understand about the setting. And that was very humbling, and it made me very cautious about diving into new contexts with no background, right. Be that linguistic or cultural, et cetera. So I did, through my doctoral work and the first research project, stuck close to Mali because I felt like that made the most sense. I was building off of relationships that I had since Peace Corps and just slowly sort of expanding the scope and the depth of those. Since then, though, in the last few years, feeling a little bit more like I could transfer some of that knowledge and also recognize that I needed to learn more about the new context, did shift and did some work in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Okay. And also worked with a nursing midwifery capacity building project that looked at frontline healthcare providers in sub-Saharan Africa in about 6 countries. And I think what I had learned on the front lines in Mali very much helped me to make some contributions, even though we were talking about different countries. And then in the last year or so, I've actually been working with frontline providers in India. And so I think what I'm seeing there are these trends about what the challenges are for frontline maternal health care providers. And so although it's not Mali, I think some of the lessons there do translate.
Sure.
Not always, but many of them do.
Yeah. So on the very first episode of the podcast, we talked to Ashley Gresh, who worked with you a little bit on the GEMS program in Mali. So can you talk a little bit about that program?
Sure. So the GEMS program is sponsored by the Center for Global Health here at Hopkins, and it's really a mechanism that is designed to try and get students involved in global work that has an interdisciplinary component to it, and in a way that they'll be working with local collaborators as well as collaborators here at Hopkins. So a mentor of mine, Peter Winch, over at the School of Public Health, has had federally funded research in Mali for many years. And I collaborated with him in the work that I did with midwives there a few years ago. And we've stayed in contact and have sort of had students, you know, working with both of us at different times, and so stayed connected about who was doing what. When the GEMS opportunity came up, it seemed like a good way to build on what was happening with a doctoral student in the School of Public Health named Molly Lassiter, whose doctoral work is examining the ethnomedical perceptions of perinatal mental health disorders in Mali. So the GEMS project was specifically designed to build on her formative work or her qualitative research, and that's how the GEMS project came into being, was a way to continue that work, move it forward.
Can I ask what GEMS stands for?
Sure.
So our listeners know.
Good. So it stands for Global Established Multidisciplinary Sites.
Okay.
So, yes.
So it's just a very broad term for working with multidisciplinary teams globally.
Exactly. So awesome. And most of the funding in the GEMS project, it's not a lot of money. Two-thirds of the money is for student support. So it's the goal of it is to get students into the field and working with an interdisciplinary team in research.
So your focus within the project is postpartum depression and developing a screening tool. Is that right?
Right. So Molly Laster, who's the PhD student there and working with Peter Winch and her team, built off of some work of other colleagues in the School of Public Health. So this is the key. You never want to reinvent the wheel. You want to build on and expand evidence that's already there. So using a process that had been carried out by other researchers in other countries before, she did, as I said, that formative work to try and start to understand, you know, is our understanding of postpartum depression, does that exist in Mali? Does it look the same? Are the symptoms the same? Do people see it as a problem? Does it disrupt women's lives like it does here? And Mali had done that formative work. We knew that, well, we knew it was probably there, and we found that it was. And I think this is, I think perinatal mental health disorders are really, I would safely say, they're probably universal. Mm-hmm. They don't always look the same, but they're everywhere. And so I think we firmly established that, but learn more about the nuances and the language and some of the symptomatology. And then the GEMS project gave us an opportunity to move that formative work one step further by saying, okay, if we have a sense of what this looks like, of what the symptoms are, how do we help frontline providers, like community health agents, like midwives, in a low-resource setting, start to screen for and potentially intervene in a setting where there is essentially zero mental health infrastructure. And if we think it's bad here, it is literally almost non-existent in a place like Mali. Yet the problem is probably more severe because the risk factor for perinatal mental health disorders are even greater. It's sort of a clash of the two of your worst-case scenarios,
right.
Really.
Right. Can you talk a little bit more about that, like what postpartum depression looks like in Mali when you say they have higher risk factors? Can you talk a little bit more about?
So we know some of the risk factors are low socioeconomic status, stress in the relationship, history of violence. This is a country where gender-based violence is normative, and by that I mean the normalcy of hitting or beating your wife is widely accepted. Female genital cutting is... Mali has some of the highest rates in the world. So in terms of violence, they're likely to have been exposed. It's also one of the poorest countries in the world, and they're under constant, chronic, everyday stress to get by. And I'm talking about food get by, not just, you know, make the car payment. So that's what I mean by them being at higher risk. The other thing is we know that mental health disorders have a particular opportunity in the perinatal period. So in Mali, where the total fertility rate is really high, many women are either pregnant or recently pregnant. And so they're almost always in that high-risk category of being in that perinatal setting. And then in terms of what it looks like, definitely want to credit Molly and her team to this. So this included Molly and a couple of local research assistants who spent just unbelievable amounts of time in the field talking to health providers, but mostly women, about what they were experiencing. And there is a syndrome, we'll call it a syndrome for the moment. We think it's called Dusukasi, which seems the closest connection to what we would recognize as postpartum depression or even perinatal depression. And it has some features that we would recognize, difficulty sleep, feeling sort of hopeless and down. It also has a few things that culturally for us we might not have predicted. And these are the kinds of things that we had to add on to the screener because they weren't included in what in our Western setting we identified as the common symptoms. So one of those was really wanting to be by oneself and maybe not engaging in greetings as enthusiastically or regularly as is normative in that community.
Oh, wow.
For
that's
us,
really interesting.
We don't often greet people that we know well. And so that's not on our screening tools. Things that are on our screening tools that didn't resonate with them were questions like, I look forward to the future. Here we think a lot about our future and we program it sometimes down to the minute and the month, and including when we have babies and when we go to grad school and when we get married and all that good stuff. In that setting, that was a question where it was just like the blank stare. It just, they just don't have, and I don't want to generalize here, certainly, sure. But I think what we found is that for many women, the idea of, do you look forward to the future, that just didn't make sense to them. Mm-hmm. It's just not a community that strategizes quite as meticulously as we do about our future. And part of that has to do is they don't have as much control. There's also not as much mystery about the future. Okay. How their life's going to go is pretty well laid out for them in many cases. And so that's something we had to take off the tool because it just didn't make sense to include it for them.
Wow, that's really interesting. Do you think that healthcare providers and the women were open to using the screening tool? And is there any stigma associated with postpartum depression? Or I'm sorry, what was the term that they used?
Dusukasi is the term. No guarantees, but right now that's the syndrome we're working with. It basically means like bleeding heart or hurting heart. And stigma, I think there's definitely stigma. In fact, if you go to the best hospital in the country, is up by the University of Bamako. It's kind of up on a hill near where the presidential compound is. So it's a little bit set apart in the capital. And the mental health sort of, what do you want to call it, like department?
Mm-hmm. Or ministry?
Not the ministry, but the actual, the care. I'm blanking on the name. The mental health sort of unit is literally like off to the side of the rest of the hospital. And it just speaks volumes, really, about how mental health is perceived there. And much like here, people see it, it's something to be embarrassed of, it's something to be ashamed of. At the same time, because many abnormalities, be they mental health or other physical disabilities, are so often left unattended to in a low-resource setting, in some ways people accept it in a way they don't hear. Because people get like, oh, she's the crazy lady. Oh, he's the guy that has no left arm. And everybody just says what is obvious, and there sometimes isn't the same kind of shame. Mm-hmm. But mental health still has a particular stigma, and there's also a lot of beliefs about the influence of curses and spells and other things that might explain someone's unusual behavior that you would find in the West. It would be more unusual for someone to attribute certain mental health behaviors to something outside of that person as opposed to a spell someone cast on them. So I'm not sure if I answered your question,
yeah,
but that has to do with some of this. The stigma is definitely still there. And many people see pregnancy as a challenging time anyway. So sometimes some of the symptomatology was just viewed as it's just pregnancy as opposed to this is something that's actually a challenge that not all pregnant women face.
Mm-hmm. What does care for mental health issues during pregnancy look like? Was that a ridiculous question? Because there's no care.
No, it doesn't look like anything because it isn't anything, at least not formally.
Mm-hmm.
What we found, what we did is after we had that formative work, we took that and compared item by item with a couple established screeners, the Johns Hopkins System Checklist and the Edinburgh Postpartum Depression Scale. And then we looked at all the language that was coming up in the formative research. And there were a few different tools we used to pull out symptoms and functions we thought might change and came up with a list of things that we thought would work for a new screener. What we found in testing this with women, we did a test with about 40 women and then endless debate with the psychiatric professionals that do exist in Mali, and there are literally like a handful, and then lots of women came up with a screener, tested that with 40 women, made further adjustments, and then just finished testing it with another 180. And we're running the analysis now to look at reliability and validity of that screener to find out if it's something that now can be used by, you know, your average midwife out in the community. So in answer to your question is, I'm not sure how acceptable it will be. We think it has the potential to be. These frontline providers in low-resource settings who are rarely supervised, often not paid, and have almost no tools, and I'm talking like a third of them don't have a blood pressure cuff,
wow,
to have a tool to help them, any kind of shortcut to help recognize women who might need additional assistance, I think will be welcome. That said, what we found while we were doing the reliability and validity testing with these 180, actually 220 women altogether, is that women did disclose that they were struggling and that they often had maybe one person, a sister, an auntie, or someone. So there are these informal networks of mental health support that exist, just like they do in our communities, but they're harder to see. And as you might expect, your auntie or your sister or your sister-in-law, there might be some power dynamics at play. For example, women in Mali marry into their husband's family, and so they come in sort of lower on the social totem pole. So if she's having problems, who she can confide to, because a lot of those problems are related to the relationship, mm-hmm. There might be limits to what she can say and who she can say it to. And but there are those networks of emotional support, but there really is no network of formal support. Literally, mm-hmm. there is no network. So women really do suffer in silence and learn to keep going.
Wow. We might have to do a future podcast on global mental health.
Yeah. Got it, Anne.
There you go.
Can't wait.
Lots to discuss.
What does the actual screening tool look like? Is it a checklist like we have here? We run down a list of questions and just tally it up?
Yep. Right. So, for example, a lot of people know the Edinburgh Postpartum Depression mm-hmm. Scale, and that's a 10-item thing. It's so easy to do. It takes people literally like a minute or two to complete. Right now, that's the problem with our tool. It's 26 items, and it is not self-administered like the Edinburgh, but it's actually something that's read. So that's another difference in using a screening tool for a very low literacy population. You're not going to hand them a piece of paper and ask them to complete it because the literacy rates are so low. So it's something the provider has to be able to understand themselves and administer to them and then score it and be able to get a sense of, is this person at risk or not? And so unlike the Edinburgh, right now it is longer and it is not self-administered, but it would be administered by a trained provider.
And is there any expectation on the provider to intervene after the screening tool is used? And is there any what are your expectations for the use of the screening tool and intervening later?
Right. So that gets us. So that's a really good question, because if we know these perimental health disorders. These perinatal mental health disorders are so common, yet I've just said there is no research infrastructure. What are the ethics of uncovering people who need help and who are in mental health distress? And I think what is encouraging is that there are many examples of low-resource settings where community-based interventions actually can be helpful. And in this case, I'm speaking obviously about women. There are some good examples from other parts of Sub-Saharan Africa, including post-conflict zones where stress is particularly high in places like Congo, that show that community-based, sometimes interpersonal behavior, interpersonal therapy can be done, group-based therapy can be done. Mm-hmm. And even we all recognize the importance of being heard and listened to. We heard after people tested the tool with us and were asked a few questions about what they thought of the questions, because we were trying to refine it. They often expressed relief that they were able to talk about it. And this is really, I think, at the root of why community-based mental health interventions are viable, because sometimes people just aren't talking about it or being heard. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to propose that we can fix serious mental health pathology of women all around the world or in a place like Mali, but I think that we can start to bring some comfort to women who may feel, at this time, really alone.
So have you actually practiced as a midwife in Mali?
No, I am not practiced as a midwife in Mali. So after I did Peace Corps, I came back, did my public health and midwifery and nursing training, and then my doctoral research was with frontline maternal health providers. They're called matrones. And I went back after I did my dissertation work, which was a qualitative study about, like, what is their day-to-day life like? That's what really fascinated me. I couldn't believe what these women pulled off in a day. And so after the doctoral work, what I heard from them loud and clear during that data collection was that, that they didn't have the resources they need or the skills they needed to do what they were being asked to do, essentially. Mm-hmm. So for the next few years, I worked with an organization that was designed to provide opportunities for continuing education for these frontline providers. So for about 4 years, over the space of four years, they had three continuing education sessions that afforded the frontline maternal health providers the opportunity to come in, meet with their bosses, their locally highly skilled trainers, of which there are several, get them all in the same room at the same time. So I did not practice as a midwife in Mali, was a cheerleader for a lot of births, but and was closely involved with coordinating some of that. But what was really important to me to see is that in a lot of international agencies, the goal is to build capacity, right? But who do you build capacity with? You come in and you have your training in the capital, in the air-conditioned hotel, mm-hmm. and the best of the best of the best health workers with the right connections get invited to that. But the people on the front lines are not the same group. That frustrated me. And so what we did with this group was make sure that those frontline providers were the people who were brought in. Now that worked. I think it worked. We saw some changes in their confidence to do things like prevent postpartum hemorrhage. In particular, also to use the partogram, which is a way to try and identify women who might need to be referred early enough to refer them. Challenges with things like that are that you take people out of their post for the time they're being trained. So I'm really interested in more innovative training programs like embedded mentors. This is what we're doing in India, or I'm helping a bit to evaluate, is a program where mentors were embedded in the facility. So the midwife doesn't have to go anywhere. Her mentor comes to her or her and her colleagues, and then the mentor moves around over time. And so that keeps people in their sight, but also gives them that real on-the-job, you know, learning while you're working.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen any change in midwifery cares over your many years of working in Mali?
Mali faces so many challenges, period. Mali is stuck in a way that is painful in terms of its development. Things have changed. Communication has improved. Mm-hmm. I think it's much easier for even frontline matrons in rural villages to get their supervisor on the phone and to ask questions and to maybe troubleshoot a referral more quickly than they could have before mobile phones were so ubiquitous. So that's been a wonderful thing. The extent to which their training has improved or their supervision or their compensation or their job stress, I'm not sure that's changed. In fact, it's probably gotten worse because in a place like Mali, unfortunately, in the last few years, they have been subjected to terrorism attacks that they never have been. There have been three significant events in the past couple of years that sends people running away from the country. It makes, when you call a consultant and want them to come and do work, people don't want to go. And so Mali is at a particularly vulnerable time because they were already so challenged. And now that terror has entered into the picture, they become in some ways fundable, but in some ways quite a challenge to recruit people to work in because the stakes have risen considerably. So there's a lot of work to do, obviously. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about how that translates into what midwifery, the practice of midwifery kind of looks like in Mali now, maybe comparing it to what midwifery looks like in the United States? Like obviously there's a difference of resources, but how about like cultural differences or how the practice is kind of received?
Sure, yeah. So I think overall, so one thing I want to say just in terms of scope of practice, midwifery looks really different in sub-Saharan Africa than it does and I'm going to just refer to the U.S. because our midwifery looks yet different than it would in Scandinavia or in other parts of Europe. In sub-Saharan Africa, to be a skilled birth attendant, by definition, you need to be able to do things like manual vacuum extraction, and that's clearing out the products of conception, for example, after a miscarriage. Mm-hmm. That's not something that midwives here would need to have in their basic skill set. Also things like being able to initiate and manage antiretroviral therapy. That is a core skill of a midwife in many sub-Saharan African countries. Not Mali, because fortunately their HIV AIDS rates are not very high, but in places like, you know, Malawi or Lesotho, that is your basic skill set. So I always want to make sure people recognize that when you want to go and be a midwife or a health provider of any kind in another setting, what is their burden, because it looks different than ours. And then in terms of midwifery in Mali, I think culturally they are typically very honored because they're healthcare providers. But in my experience, midwives can have a very different life in their community depending on if they were born and raised in that community versus they were posted there from, say, a regional capital, and this is where they were sent by the Ministry of Health. There are all sorts of social dynamics at work when the very same people you have to convince, because look, when you need to do a referral with a woman, you enter men's worlds because you need mopeds, you need donkeys, you need carts. Men control those things. So when a young midwife, or even an old one, wants a referral to happen, she has to enter into men's worlds. And that means, will she have that influence? If they saw that same midwife, born and raised in their community, they've seen her run around in her, you know, little shorts or whatever for years, does she wield the same influence? Can she affect the change that a guest into the community can do? Mm-hmm. And so what we're seeing are these real, very practical implications for their influence in the community based on whether or not they're from there or whether they were posted there. And so in addition to the skill set, we also have to think about how the community listens to that person at a time of crisis. So those are some of the things at play for frontline midwifery and Molly that you wouldn't think here. Like, I'm probably not going to run into, like, the uncle I grew up with when I'm trying to make a crisis decision.
Right.
So, and that's, and I think in low-resource settings, that's more often to happen, more likely to happen.
I think that's a pretty good segue, just because I'm self-interested, like a lot of people, and I have an interest in global health, and I know Anne does too, and that's why we're sitting in these chairs. Do you have any suggestions for students or healthcare workers looking to get involved in global health, and do you think a public health degree is an asset and a necessary asset?
How do we become you?
That's actually a more concise way of saying what I was asking.
Harried and yeah, okay, wow, all right. I feel like I sound a little bit like a broken record, but you need to, and it's not always easy to do. Peace Corps is not the only way to do it, but you have got to spend a long period of time in a place where you are essentially, you are the absolute minority in every way. I think there's no way to make yourself a better, more empathetic provider here in the U.S. or make you better prepared for working abroad, because you can have all the clinical credentials in the world, but people aren't going to hire you or want you as a consultant unless they know that you're going to be able to hit the ground and be operational. Mm-hmm. You're not going to sort of like crumble into, you know, a heap of tears at the fact that, you know, you can't get the water you want when you need it. There's simple things like that. And then if I say Peace Corps, and lots of people roll their eyes at that, but there's just so few opportunities where you can get someone else to pay for you to get the best language training and the best cultural training, probably, some of the finest that's available. Also, Peace Corps now has a program for experienced clinicians who want to work abroad, and that's new in the last few years. They've just expanded, I think, to a fourth country, and that is called the Global Health, I'm going to forget the complete acronym,
the
Partnerships.
Seed Program, is that what you're thinking
Seed
of?
Seed Program is a partner with Peace Corps in administering that. So they're actually sending experienced nurses, and they have a great need for midwives and physicians. And right now the contracts are about a year. They're looking at the contracts being longer, and I do believe they're looking at people also being able to bring family, which Peace Corps has always just been the individual. But they recognize sometimes they can recruit more people if there's a little more flexibility. So that's something that people who are experienced clinicians might think about, because after a stint like that, and typically you're placed with a counterpart with who you are on the job mentoring, and you're also learning, of course, many, many things, because you bring certain skills and they have certain skills. And then after that, you're very well positioned to be a consultant, to work abroad. I think a lot of people who want to work abroad need to think about the fact your main job is going to be about building capacity and teaching and transferring knowledge. There are real ethical questions involved in going abroad and thinking, I'm going to catch babies, or I'm going to, like, diagnose a lot of childhood pneumonia. Mm-hmm. That's great, but you're going to go away, and what have you left in the local health workforce?
Then what happens?
That right. is durable after you leave.
Right.
And that sounds trite now. I think this audience probably knows that well. But you always need to be really critical of your engagements and make sure that what you're doing is something that's going to last after you leave. And making sure that they're setting the agenda and not you or your organization.
So the best experience is experience.
Yeah.
Got it.
Someone told me that about running. Like, if you want to run fast, you have to run fast.
Oh, no,
and I thought, that's horrible. It's true about experience. Like, the best experience is you have to put in that time. And a lot of people, I'll be frank, just don't want to put in the time. They mm-hmm. want it to be a quick week or two mission, but you don't get to a point where someone's going to send you for a week or two unless you have paid those dues early.
That makes complete sense. It does.
Kind of a bitter pill to swallow sometime. But, anyway.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast, Nicole.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening, and tune in on the first Thursday of every month for a new episode. You can find more information about the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing Center for Global Initiatives at nursing.jhu.edu/CGI.
I mean, I would want to listen to that.